This is InvestTalk. Independent thinking, shared success. Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, September 12th, 2022 edition. I look forward to this hour with you. I am Justin Klein, and I'm ready to answer your finance and investment questions. And the phone number you'll want to use, as always, to give me a call right now is 888-99-CHART. That's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Leave a message or talk to me live, which I love the live callers as well. Now, I've got a packed podcast for you today, and my focus point concerns the question behind, are there good inflation-fighting investments for retirement portfolios? And we're going to break down the pros and cons of each, because remember, every investment has their pros and cons, their risk versus reward, and it's vital that whenever you're putting money to work, you are well aware of both sides, okay? Now, time permitting, I have some other topics to discuss. One is the amount of flows in the tech sector, money going in, money going out. So I want to go over that because two months ago, I did kind of give an overview, and I want to give an update on that. And then I want to touch on the impacts for the European economy, European manufacturing economy mainly, when it comes to the shutting off of Russian gas and the cost of energy over there, and the fact that that feeds into global supply chains and thus inflation here in the US. So I want to look at that. Also, the junk bond market. Things are shifting just a bit underneath the feet of the junk bond market, and I really want to dive into that because that is always a good leading indicator of what's happening in the broader economy. So those are the things that are on my mind, but ultimately, this show is about you. So I need to know what is on your mind and what you're thinking about. So let's check in on the market. Actually, yeah, we're gonna get some voice bank questions today. We're gonna talk about Vale and is it a good time to buy euros right now? And I have a perspective on the car market and going back in history and helping you understand where that is compared to history today. So I've got this all planned, but I want to pivot over to the market right now. Today, the S&P was up a little over 1%, about 43 points there. You had the NYSE, which is a much broader index, up about 161 points, and also up a little over 1%. And you had, growth. The growth stocks outperformed a bit today, even though rates were up. The 10-year was up about 4 basis points. The dollar was down, so that was a bit of a positive. And that was really on the back of the euro getting a bit of a bid. Part of that, my estimation, had to do with the recent gains on Ukraine against the Russian army in the northeastern part of Ukraine. And, you know, they're showing resilience, showing fight, and a little more optimism around that situation over there, which is certainly going to feed into the expectations, future expectations for energy prices and Europe growth prospects, etc. So that was, I think, one of the main reasons. Now, tomorrow, we have a big economic number, and that is the CPI report. And I've talked about how I expect it to surprise a bit to the downside, but we certainly shall see. That will go a long way to indicating to the Fed whether or not their inflation fight is working or not. So that was the market today. Really, the biggest story, though, was actually the silver market. SLV itself was up 85 cents and over 4%. So the biggest kind of sharp move in the precious metal space after a major sell-off. So I thought that was interesting and something of note, and that could be the start of a broader precious metal rally. So that's the market today, and we're going to have fireworks likely tomorrow as well. Now let's pivot over to our first listener question now.
Hi, Steve, Justin. I'm calling from San Francisco, KDOW, and I'm thinking of adding this iShare robotic artificial intelligence to my portfolio to diversify. But before I do that, I would like your opinion. So can you tell me what information you have regarding this iShare robotic artificial intelligence? Okay, thank you, and I'll be listening. Goodbye now.
All right, looking at the thematic fund, there are a lot of these days, and this is the iShares Robotics and Artificial Intelligence ETF, multi-sector ETF, and it does have an expense ratio of about 47 basis points, which is a little on the high end for an ETF. But it's going to be very concentrated on the growth side of the market. And historically, these thematic funds are launched at a pretty poor time. And this was launched in 2018. Now, they had the nice COVID tailwinds when all the money flowed into the growth stocks. And this one did very well. Bottom around 20, went all the way up to $50 and change. Now it's back to about 28 and change. And clearly in a downtrend, very similar to the tech stocks more broadly. And actually mirrors more the ARK funds more than anything. 63% of this fund is in tech, 11% industrial, 17% communication services. And this is exactly where I do not want to be in this environment. Most of these names are very overvalued. They're now in a downtrend, still trading at crazy multiples. And you want to be in this fund when it finally gets washed out. And I think there's still too much optimism around the tech space, especially with inflation, while expected to come down, going to be sticky high. And that's not going to be good for the growth stocks. And you can see that as of late. This continues to kind of languish near its 52-week lows, not really getting a great bounce either. So remember, be looking at companies that produce hard, real assets. That's what this decade is going to be about. And while there's certainly going to be a trend towards robotics and artificial intelligence, I think there's probably too much hype there, especially on the artificial intelligence side. And I'd rather be buying the companies that are more focused on robotics, more focused on the industrial side. Those are the companies that I would be interested in. So this is not the type of broad-based ETF that I would be interested in. So I'm passing. Now we're heading into a break, and I welcome your finance and investment questions right now. So give InvestTalk a call at 888-99-CHART.
Why do listener questions make InvestTalk better?
Which of these would you recommend?
Because each caller presents fresh questions in their voice.
I was curious if you still think aluminum has a ways to go from here.
When do I know the right time to take profits?
Should I be looking for an exit? Should I be holding here?
And listeners instinctively realize that InvestTalk uniquely offers a welcome dose of investing satisfaction.
I think you have a terrific show, and I've learned a whole lot.
Hey guys, love your show. I've been listening for several years now, and I've learned a lot.
Justin Klein and Steve Peasley understand what investors need and want.
I would look at it from a tax perspective. If there's no tax implications, move on, find better ways to use that money.
I'm going with the odds. I think a half position now would at least get you in it and get you watching it so you won't lose track of it.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART. Each day, InvestTalk listeners submit their finance and investment questions via phone or email. Would you like your question to be put near the top of the list? Just take a minute or two to leave a review and rating for InvestTalk at iTunes. And be sure to include a brief question with your iTunes review comments.
Now, Now, my focus point concerns, the story behind this question, are there good inflation fighting investments for retirement portfolios? And portfolio allocations for those in retirement should include a blend of inflation hedges and inflation beaters, as well as then, you know, the types of names that align with your risk tolerance levels. So we're going to talk about this. And, you know, there's a 2019 Society of Actuaries survey, and they surveyed pre-retirees and retirees, and they asked what the issues they worried about the most. And two-thirds of pre-retirees cited inflation as a key worry. And remember, this is 2019 when inflation was kind of bouncing around at the 2% level. But now they were very prescient, and they kind of predicted that in a way. And now inflation obviously is running in the high single digits. And retirees can confront the battle with inflation by buying the right investments in their portfolio. And there are kind of three types. One are broad inflation hedges. Another are narrow inflation hedges, and then inflation beaters. So that's one, two, and three. So we're gonna go into that. Now, broad inflation hedges typically align with two groups, and that would be one that track the price of the CPI, and others that reflect a smaller basket, such as commodities or real estate. And you know, you have your TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, or I-bonds. Those are pretty popular. They're pretty safe, direct inflation hedges, and their yields are directly tied to the CPI report. Obviously, I-bonds have severe purchase constraints, so $10,000 per year, limit how effective they can be for somebody with a large amount of money. So be aware of that. But obviously, TIPS, there are other drawbacks. You can buy more, but there's also the sensitivity to interest rates. And that's why you can buy short-term TIPS or longer-term TIPS or intermediate-term TIPS. And that depends on your goals with that money. If it's going to be used in the near term, short-term TIPS are probably better. Long-term time horizons, intermediate TIPS are probably better. So those are the broad inflation hedges. And then there's the narrow inflation hedges. And those are tied to specific parts of the economy, either directly or indirectly. So for example, you can buy a commodity tracking fund. That's going to be a bunch of different commodities, or you can even buy specific funds that track basic materials, energy, agriculture, etc. And the big risk is there is that because they're so narrow, they're probably not always going to reflect your basic needs, right? You might pick the wrong time. You might pick the wrong part of the economy for an inflation hedge, and therefore might not go up as much as the inflation in your life is, right? So that's really the risk there, okay? And then there's also real estate investment trusts. So this is also kind of a narrow inflation hedge, because typically when there is inflation, the owners of buildings, shopping malls, hotels, et cetera, they increase their prices. That feeds into payouts and all that. But there's still that same type of risk that's not going to reflect one for one exactly what you're feeling in the broader economy. Now, there's more important the consideration, though, besides just that tracking of inflation, is the risk that you're taking with these. Obviously, commodities go up and down pretty fast, and you can have great times in the commodity world, and you can have terrible times. And so you'd have to understand that risk profile and whether you're comfortable with that. Okay. And then timing, you know, a lot of people chase, and they often chase at the wrong time. And so you really need to have a longer term view of this. And for those that maybe are less risk tolerant, you know, I think REITs are going to be a better fit than a commodity type fund. Okay. So those are the ones that track inflation. And then the other would be inflation beaters, which these are ones that over a long period of time, they tend to outperform inflation. So that doesn't mean that every year it's going to be exactly the same. Some years it'll outperform, some years it might underperform. It's not going to track one for one. You know, this year's a good example. Equities historically have been beaters of inflation. Last year it was, this year is not, right? It's not going to track one for one. Long term, equities usually beat inflation by about 5 to 7%. Okay. Now then the question is, what type of companies tend to do well? Okay. And those are ones that have dividends that are increasing, dividend growth companies, not just that are paying out a dividend, but can grow their dividend over time and ideally more than the rate of inflation. Okay. So usually higher quality, less volatile stocks tend to do better in that environment. And you want to de-emphasize just the simple no dividend growth companies. Okay. Well, we're going to a quick break. Jeremy from Michigan, hang on. You'll be with us next here on Invest Talk at 888-99-CHART.
One of the most rewarding things I do each weekday is host the Invest Talk podcast. I truly enjoy helping investors, and I know that every question counts and every answer I provide will be unbiased. You, the caller, get to chart the course for each InvestTalk podcast. Call with your questions anytime, day or night, 888-99-CHART.
Go talk to Jeremy in Michigan looking at Intel.
Hey, Justin. So Intel has dropped to a price that I consider really attractive, but the chart looks really bad. Has lost 50% since early 2021. So I was wondering what you thought I should look for to identify a good buy point.
Well, you want to look obviously for chart strength that will indicate that this downturn is getting close to its end. I'm starting to see a little bit of it, but not nearly enough for me to get excited about the near-term prospects. Now, long-term, Intel has, you know, good technology. Sir, they've had a lot of inroads made by companies like AMD, and they're being brought down with the whole chip sector as a whole, which is weak. So the big question is, will their new CEO, who used to be their CTO, be able to turn the tide? And will the new CHIPS Act, where they're building more chip foundries here, they're going to produce for other companies, et cetera. You know, that long term is, a vision that will pay dividends if they can execute well on it. But that's still a big if. And the chart is not indicating that that is, you know, in the near term future. It's more long term hope, I guess you could say. So what you want to do is look for where this downtrend has been contained, and it's really been contained within the 50-day moving average. It's found resistance there, and you know, especially the 100-day. That's probably where I would, you know, it'd be an indication that okay, things have actually turned. If it can get above the 100-day moving average, the 50 will be kind of the first check mark, and then the second would be that 100-day moving average, which is up around $39 per share now that we're at $31.56. And it's a heavily shorted name, so it's probably one of those names where you see like a big surge that will push the price up quickly and fast, and that would be that first indication that the trend is shifting. But we're not seeing that quite yet. I like that it's on your radar because I think there's a lot of value down here, but we're not getting a lot of check marks near term that tells me this is going to turn the other way. Thanks for the call. Now, people can take the time to leave an Invest Talk podcast review on iTunes. We'd like to thank them for their courtesy by getting to their question quickly. Chris from Guam says, I'm considering adding a media company to my portfolio. What do you think is a better buy? Warner Brothers, WBD, or Paramount, P-A-R-A? Now, Warner Brothers is a recent spinoff, Warner Brothers Discovery. So it's a merger / spinoff between, I remember AT&T owned Warner Brothers. They merged with Discovery and spun that off. And really the stock's been in a downtrend since. And this is very common for spinoffs, especially for a large company like AT&T, where the owners of the AT&T stock are typically in for the dividend. Well, Warner Brothers was spun off and they're not paying a dividend. So if you're in a dividend ETF, for example, and you want to, you can only own companies that pay a dividend, and there's a spinoff that doesn't pay a dividend, you have to sell it. And that's been in a consistent downtrend ever since. Their business has obviously been in flux recently, but I actually think this is a much better franchise than Paramount. Remember, Warner Brothers is HBO, and HBO has a much longer track record of consistency. Now, they certainly have CNN, that one's struggling, and they're trying to reimagine CNN, maybe into something that's, at least in their view, less partisan. And they own other franchises like Superman, Rick and Morty, Game of Thrones, obviously with HBO. And so I think just overall, their suite of franchises are a lot stronger than Paramount. And I think the price is a lot cheaper. Paramount, while it has come down, is continuing to struggle. And maybe it's just me. I'm just not a huge fan of their franchises. So they're CBS, Viacom, so think of Nickelodeon, MTV, BET, Comedy Central, VH1, CMT. You know, some of those still have some traction, but I feel like they're just a little dated. Not a lot of new franchises like a Game of Thrones that are doing very well. And so if I'm picking one or the other, I'm absolutely picking Warner Brothers. Thanks for the call. Now let's touch on, where are we going to go to? Let's talk about tech stocks quickly. We'll probably have to pick it up after the break as well. But there's been a, actually, let me pick this up on the other side of this break. There's some new data on where money is flowing within the tech space. And I think it will be vital to help you understand the sentiment within that part of the market. Now, on the next Invest Talk, the story behind this headline. With more Fed rate hikes likely, how do they affect your wallet? Adjustable rate mortgages could be affected by interest rate hikes, and so will other credit products like credit cards. But for now, I'm Justin Klein. I'm ready to take your questions live at 888-99-CHART.
Have you heard about Riskalyze? It's a brief question and answer form that you fill out online. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein will also get a copy of your responses. They can use the Riskalyze results to help you formulate a strategy that fits your investing risk tolerance. Learn more anytime and take the Riskalyze quiz at investtalk.com.
chart 888-992-4278. Let's touch on the tech sector. If you don't know the numbers, you don't know your business. That's true when your business is growing fast, and even more true when there's a lot of uncertainty. Inflation is running rampant, supply chains are clogged, and labor market is tight. What does that mean for margins? But not every business is in the dark, and NetSuite is helping business owners everywhere. Over 31,000 businesses know their numbers because they use NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud financial system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control of your financials, planning, budgeting, and of course, inventory, so you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need, all in one place. In 2022, profit is the new growth. So NetSuite helps you identify rising costs, automate your manual business processes, and see where to save money. Know your numbers, know your business, and get to know how NetSuite can be the source of truth for your entire company. Right now, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/investtalk right now. netsuite.com/investtalk. netsuite.com/investtalk. As a whole. And what's interesting is that investors are selling out of technology-focused mutual funds and ETFs at the fastest clip since February. And that was the first time the tech sector tech sell-off really intensified. They pulled out about $2.4 billion from those type of funds in the 3 weeks ending last Wednesday. What's interesting, though, is that that was right near the beginning of a bit of a rally in the markets. And, you know, that's typical timing, bad timing for fickle investors. And even after rallying 4.1% this week, the NASDAQ is down is down around 3.1% over the past month, and underperformed the S&P, which is off only 1.3% over the past month. That was before today's move. Now, overall this year, the NASDAQ is down 23%, and that would be the worst performance since 2002, which was in the midst of the first dot-com bust. Now, a lot of this had to do with the sell-off in the bond markets and higher interest rates. We've talked about that, making those future cash flows less attractive. And the shift in the economy has also hurt analyst expectations, which are coming down in a big, big way. And tech stocks still are pretty richly valued. On average, the forward 12-month P/E ratio of Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, Tesla, Meta Platforms, and NVIDIA, 38 versus the S&P, 16.7. And expectations for third quarter earnings within the information technology sector and the communication sector, that's where Facebook and Google are housed, are down about 9 and 13% respectively over the past 2 months. So expectations for those businesses are coming down rapidly, and especially those in the semiconductor space, NVIDIA, AMD, they face some of the biggest selling as of late. Why? Because analysts continue to believe that the worst downturn in a decade in the semiconductor space is just ahead of us as inventories build and, you know, slower demand for physical products builds inventory. Okay, so and if you look at the options measured called skew, it measures how costly it is to protect against further declines within stocks like Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, NVIDIA, etc. They are at the highest level in a while, and that is a sign that traders are positioning for even bigger drops within that sector. And a lot will hinge on what the Fed does. You know, when do they pivot? So maybe they're protecting at the wrong time, or we could get a counter trend rally. But some investors are still bargain hunting. And that's why I say I don't think the sentiment is completely washed out within the space. Although people are pulling money out, it's not at a level where everyone's despondent. I'm still getting a ton of questions within the tech space. We got the call earlier about the robotics ETF. People are still hopeful in the hope phase. And, you know, it takes kind of grinding losses and just you know, to get sentiment from where it's just drastically over-optimistic to something of despondence. And we're in the middle of that. And in despondence, that's where you get great buying opportunities. But we're not quite there yet, because recently those leverage ETFs to the NASDAQ recorded its biggest one-day inflow since early June. So I wanted to give you an overview of that space and let you know that we're not quite at that capitulation phase yet. Now let's pivot to the InvestTalk voice bank for a question that came in earlier from San Francisco.
Hi, this is Dan from the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm calling about stock symbol BALE. I don't know if it's pronounced Bale or Valley. Anyway, I was wondering how the heck they can afford to pay such a high dividend. At this time, it's like 23%. Thanks a lot for your answer. Bye.
All right, looking at Vale, I think that's how you pronounce it. And yeah, if you look at the previous yield, you're going to look like it's paying a huge amount. But their business did really well in 2021. That's expected to come down. But you also have to realize that their business is denominated not in dollars. It's a Brazilian company. And their rule of law is a little bit different than ours as well. And so that means the risk within this is different. And their business is all around. If you look at the history of their cash flows and their dividends and their earnings. And this happened in 2011 when their dividend went from 8 cents a share to $1.12 in about a year. And you've kind of seen that recently, but it's coming back down again. So this is, you know, it paid September of last year, it paid $1.50, but this recent quarter, it paid 68 cents. So it's cut the dividend, right? So if you extrapolate 68 cents out for an entire year, that's something closer to, yeah, that's not 10%. So remember, too many people focus on what is the dividend yield they're seeing on the screen. And you always need to go look at the dividend history. Is this a company that is consistently paying the same dividend each and every quarter? Or is it volatile? Does it go up and down based on their economic prospects, based on currency fluctuations? Because that happens a lot too, where it's a foreign company and it pays out based on its local currency, but how that translates into dollars depends on how strong or weak the dollar is compared to that currency, like the Brazilian real right now. So you always need to do a little digging. And remember, dividends are not sacrosanct. They can move however they want. This is not a bond. Dividends are not bonds. You buy a bond, they're going to pay you that set coupon unless they default. And that's how it works. It's pretty straightforward and simple. Dividends, sometimes they're straightforward and simple. You know, the big blue chip names, they kind of increase their dividend a couple percent per year and it's kind of consistent. But commodity names, absolutely not. Their business is all over the board. They can eliminate their dividend very easily. It's not something that they have to do. So does that mean you shouldn't buy Vale? No, I think it's a pretty good risk versus reward after this large pullback. But don't expect 10% dividend because it's likely going to come in lower. Thanks for the call. Now, my perspective today looks at cars, and a large part of our economy and lifestyle over the years involves cars. And when they were first invented, cars were called automobiles. Kind of crazy, right? Seems ancient to call them automobiles today. But with the push towards EVs gaining momentum, you might wonder how large the U.S. auto market is compared to the rest of the world. Now, more Americans today are driving older cars than in previous years. Part of that had to do with, hey, they were forced to. Price of cars were too high. They couldn't really get into a new car at a reasonable price. And 16-year-old cars and trucks comprise 21.1% of the vehicles in the U.S. Now, 53.3 million older cars are so-called pre-99 models still being driven. And if you want to know how many cars there are on Earth, 1.446 billion vehicles in the world. Pretty crazy, right? 19% of those vehicles are in the U.S., but most of the cars, about one-third, are in Asia. Obviously, China is a big chunk of that. Europe is about 28% of the world's vehicles, and North America in whole, including Mexico and Canada, 24% of the total. And how many cars are on the road in the U.S.? As of 2021, about 289 million. And if you look at the production of cars, back in 1924, we only produced about 3.6 million cars. It was about 4.3 million by 1928. But in comparison, in 1928, the UK only produced 212,000, Germany 90,000, Russia 1,000. So we dominated. That's how GM and Ford became so big. They were the main producer of cars in the entire world. Okay. And back in 1913, there were only 485,000 cars made here in the U.S. Now we produce that here in the U.S. in a couple of week period. And how many EVs are on the road today in the U.S.? Only 2 million. So think about that. Less than 1% of the cars on the road are EVs. And the average cost of an EV? $60,000. So pretty expensive when you think about it. And makes it difficult for I think these EV companies to really get to scale, to where they're profitable, to where they're reasonably priced. Think of the cost of the inputs right now. They're already on the rise, and it's only 2 million vehicles on the EV side. So, you know, a lot of hope around the sector, but it's going to be very difficult, especially for the auto makers, the EV makers, to make profits anytime soon. Now, iTunes, let's pivot back to an iTunes review question. No Clue says, 15% of my portfolio is in cash now, and I've been looking at value funds. My attention gets diverted to dividends, so what are your thoughts on RDIV and SPYD, or should I find the best large cap value fund in ETF? Well, you're looking at two ETFs that are focused on high dividends. The SPYD is the S&P 500 high dividend ETF, and then the other is the Invesco S&P Ultra Dividend Revenue ETF. And neither of them get me too excited, to be honest with you. And you know, if I'm picking one or the other, let's see. I mean, the good thing about RDIV, no technology shares, mainly focused on energy, 10%, financial services, 22%, industrials only 5%, which is kind of low, 20% in healthcare and 17% in utilities. So that heavy healthcare portfolio makes me a bit queasy. I don't like it that high. Whereas SPYD, that's more focused on financial services, 9% energy, a little more diversified, 14% real estate. I like that. So I'm picking one or the other. It's definitely going to be SPYD. But if you're looking for, I would go with more of a value fund, a large cap value fund, because that's what these basically are. They're large cap value funds, but with only dividend payers. But I wouldn't focus on high dividends. If you're focusing on dividend funds, you want to be focused on dividend growth funds, because those long-term outperform the high dividend ETFs most of all. And then when you buy a value fund, then the manager is able to pick any company, whether it is paying a dividend or not. Think of Berkshire, right? Berkshire would be a value type of investment, but they don't pay a dividend. So they're excluded. So I don't really like that. I like the ability to kind of find the best values in the market, whether they pay a dividend or not. So SPYD over RDIV, but I'd rather go with a value fund. Now let's get another voice bank question from 888-99-CHART.
Hello, InvestTalk. My question is it a good idea to buy euros or British pounds right now that they're very low against the dollar, as a future investment, or just to have as a cash reserve and then trade them in later? That is my question. Thank you very much. Look forward to your answer on the show.
It's a great question. The euro is down, right? We're at parity. We haven't seen that since the 90s. And, you know, switching dollars into euros would be a play towards, or really a bet on the Ukraine-Russia crisis coming to an end relatively soon, that the politicians there will pivot to probably nuclear and something that from an energy standpoint is more sustainable instead of relying on cheap Russian gas. And it's going to be, I think, a long slog. But near term, you are seeing some technical support and technical improvement on the euro versus the dollar. That's really been driving the weakness in the dollar as of late, not necessarily the yen. It's more the euro. And so, you know, to diversify your currency exposure, I don't think it's a bad idea to be moving some money into the euro right now. It's certainly risky. You probably want to match that asset with a future liability. What I mean by that is you won't do that right now if you're going to go to Europe in 3 months, right? You have a planned trip, maybe not 3 months, probably don't want to go there in the dead of winter, but maybe in the spring, you're planning to go to Europe. This is a good time to maybe lock in that pretty attractive exchange rate of dollars to euros. That's the way I would think about it. But besides that, it's just more speculation, decent speculation based on the chart, but I wouldn't be wholesale doing it in a big way unless you have some, like I said, some future reason for those euros. Thanks for the call. Now, this is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein, and we have one goal here each and every weekday, which is to help move you towards your own version of financial freedom, give you the mindset, the tools, the ideas, the data to make good investment decisions for yourself. It's going to be different than the person next to you, your cousin, your friend, your brother, your sister, etc. But if you have the right mindset, you can be consistent with your decision making and do it with a clear, open mind. And that is vital in this investing game. So we are here to help you in any way we can. So we're moving into our final break. So if you're going to call, you want to do that right now at 888-99-CHART.
No two portfolios are alike, and every investor has a unique set of circumstances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Steve or Justin. Calling from Ohio. I was hoping you guys could talk about Pfizer. I know that when it was originally approved, and I'm referring to the vaccines, there was a jump in price over a 4, 5, 6 month period. And then again, when they approved the boosters, they just recently approved the new booster, and I work in a pharmacy. I've seen a lot of interest from patients. I know they also have the new COVID treatment medication, the Paxlovid, and I've actually seen a huge uptick in that being prescribed as well. My question is, do you think that would be a good short-term play, like 5 to 6 months? Just looking to see what you guys think about that, and I'll listen on the podcast. Thanks.
All right, looking at Pfizer, and I actually think it's the exact opposite because while you talk about a lot of things getting approved, what you did not point out is that the government is no longer buying these things. They have pulled back funding for the vaccine, and it's really up to the pharmaceutical or the healthcare companies and providers to pay for the vaccine. And so there's not that kind of endless supply of money coming from government. And while they approve the boosters, the data continues to come in pretty bad when it comes to long-term effectiveness of the vaccines. After about 6 months, it actually makes your ability to, you're actually more likely to catch COVID after the 6 month mark after getting a booster or the original vaccine. So obviously it doesn't help transmission. It can hurt your immune system long term, and then there's the potential side effects. And so clearly, you know, it hasn't really been great. The data as it goes along is not showing that these are as safe and really effective as they were touted to be. Now, are they right for a certain group of people? Probably, but clearly not for everybody, and that's what the data continues to show. So while they are proving it, less and less people are wanting it because they're paying attention to the data and they realize they don't need it, especially if you're young and in relatively good condition. And then when the Paxlovid, you know, they have a lot of rebound cases, so it's getting prescribed, but, you know, it's, you know, has mixed effectiveness kind of longer term. It helps near term, but then there's the bounce back. You know, Biden had it, Fauci had the bounce back from Paxlovid, et cetera. So it's a very common thing that happens. And so I actually think the vaccine industry when it comes to COVID is in stark decline. And we're actually short Moderna. Now, Pfizer, they have a lot more diversity to their business, whereas Moderna is very, very focused on the entire business basically is the vaccine. And so that's why we're not short Pfizer itself, plus Pfizer pays a dividend, etc. So absolutely not. I would not be owning Pfizer. It's in a downtrend. Its business or its prospects for its earnings are also in a downtrend from $6.50 this year to expect to be $5.25 next year. And I expect that to decline much, much further. And then you just have, I think it's been kind of a bad look for Pfizer as a brand. So absolutely, I would not own Pfizer. Thanks for the call. Lastly, let's touch on Europe. Do we have time for Europe? Okay. So what's interesting here that's happening in Europe is that the many European industries are now shutting down because they don't have access to cheap energy, and energy prices are dramatically higher. So for example, in Slovakia, a large aluminum producer in Slovakia, which actually consumed 9% of the entire country's electricity, they were paying 45 euros per megawatt hour for their power. And as of late August, they hit 1,000 euros per megawatt hour, a 20-fold increase in the costs. And so a lot of large, especially metal producers, are winding down their production. And some are just going to recycling because that's now the most profitable thing. And they're laying off workers. And especially in the fertilizer space as well, that is pivoting back here to the U.S. They're importing a lot of raw materials from the U.S. now that, you know, we still have relatively cheap energy compared to Europe. And companies like ArcelorMittal, the world's largest steelmaker, they're shutting down factories in Germany, and they've already reduced gas demand by 40%. In Germany from what they planned at the start of the year. So you're seeing that demand destruction from those high prices. But you know, they're forever shut off from cheap Russian gas, it's going to change the supply chain dynamics around the world when it comes to industrial materials. And I think that's a big opportunity for us here in the US and already pivoting to creating that supply chain here. I'm Justin Klein. This completes another Invest Talk program. Steve Peasley and I thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads. Our official Invest Talk downloads are now over the 45 million mark last week, thanks to you. And you can get your Invest Talk podcast anytime at iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and be sure to rate and review on iTunes as well. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial.